From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This is a special broadcast from the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. I'm here with Professor Tony Montero at the Democratic National Convention, Day 2.
How are you, Don? It's a pleasure to be here with you.
The same, Tony. So quite a show yesterday with the Sanders delegates, both in the daytime and in the evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. And it looks like the situation is more tense today than it was yesterday. And, you know, we were coming up here from Center City, and all over Center City are anti-Hillary Clinton demonstrators holding signs saying indict her, that they'll never vote for her. So I think we're looking at an unmanageable convention. Anything could happen. I think that they're going to prevent Hillary from speaking on Thursday.
Yeah, it's a possibility. Yeah. Just for our listeners, let's take a listen to some of the chants that happened. This is on Monday night here at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia, just after Bernie Sanders spoke.
Hey,
them. And, you know, I was on the outside. There were two marches yesterday. The first one, which I was a part of, from Center City, from City Hall down here to the Wells Fargo Center, which is about a 4 or 5 mile trek.
In 100 degree weather.
In 100 degree weather. And the first wave, we had about 2,000, 3,000 people. And then the second wave came. It looked like a Green Party contingent. And that looked like about 6,000 or 7,000.
Wow.
So the numbers just on the first day were huge. Mm. And on Sunday, the day before, there were marches that looked like anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000 people.
Wow. I mean, we'll go back to when we were in Cleveland. We saw nothing like that.
Oh, no, no. It is as though the people understand that the fight is here.
Yeah.
And the fight is with the Wall Street candidate and her cadre that control the Democratic Party. And this is a fight to wrest control of the Democratic Party from the Clintons and Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, the fight for the Republican Party was over when Trump and their rise here. And Wall Street, the money, the people, Michael Bloomberg supporting a big announcement. Michael Bloomberg supports Hillary Clinton.
And Hello? The Koch brothers.
Okay, I mean, there's an interesting alliance. And the neoliberals and the neoconservatives.
And Christy Whitman, yeah. Former Republican governor
of New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, right. Where does it end?
That's right, the entire establishment.
And the question is, you know, why has the Republican, neoliberal, neocon establishment turned against Trump?
Well, because they basically got run out by the people that brought him in.
Well, true that. But the question is, why have they
come here?
Yeah, come here.
Right.
I mean, if Trump is the fascist,
right.
And you know, the guys, the Koch brothers and those have never had a problem with fascism.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so
right.
Why are they against Trump if he's the fascist?
Well, not only that, I mean, you know, a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, everyone we hear, the Koch brothers are the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, they're the fascists. They're the ones we have to get rid of, and now suddenly they're welcomed with open arms to stop Trump, basically, and to stop the people behind them.
Well, you know, this will be the umpteenth Stop Trump movement. And really what they're saying is...
Oh, for umpteen.
Yeah, yeah, oh, for umpteen. You know, the real deal is that they want to stop the movement that has made Trump in the same way they want to stop the movement that has made Bernie.
That's right.
And we have said this over and over and over again. Let us look at these movements. Let us look at who is populating these insurgent movements of resistance.
That's right.
That's the key thing.
That's right. And so somehow, while everyone's been intellectualizing, doing market research, focus groups, babbling endlessly on television and everything else, messaging all the things that they do. The people themselves have been stumbling towards unity. We heard things that we heard on the floor of the Republican National Convention with respect to Hillary Clinton being yelled out in groups, you know, by masses of groups on the floor of the Democratic National Convention. Things like, lock her up.
That's right. I mean, it's unbelievable. But you know something, Don, and I say this modestly, we predicted this. It was so obvious. It was so obvious. And you know, you and I tried to wonder, why could the alleged left not see what was right before them?
Well, I told you, I didn't see it until you pointed it out to me. What I saw was a replay of 1932 in caricature, and we, you know, Jesus, are we really going to have to stand behind Hillary Clinton as the you know, unifying force to stop fascism and Trump and Nazism, whatever? And except for the fact that it was just too unsettling an idea to select her as a champion. And when you said, if Trump's a fascist, what is Hillary Clinton? And I had to come up with the answer, a fascist with a record. You know, the whole illusion comes crashing down, and you start looking at what you're supposed to look at, which are movements,
which is
the development of the people, which is the people trying to gravitate towards satisfaction of their own needs, finding the means themselves to do it.
Hey, look, Don, you know, you and I were out on the streets of Center City, Philadelphia this morning.
That's right.
And, you know, we were with some people from Massachusetts, from New Bedford, Massachusetts, and from Wyoming.
Wyoming, right.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, these were ordinary people, people who are organic to the working class.
Yeah.
And they were so similar to the people that we saw in Cleveland. So similar.
Yep.
And their passion, their anger at the establishment that is running this country. You know, I remember we were talking a couple of months ago, and I tried to make the point that, you know, the concept of the 1% versus the 99% that came out of Occupy, and which was an animating notion within the Sanders movement, is an addendum to that, an additional concept, was the concept that's coming out of the Trump movement. It's a rigged system.
That's right.
The economic and political systems are rigged. When you put those two concepts together, the driving force of the Trump movement, a rigged system that has to be changed, and the idea of the 1% versus the 99%, you have two movements that have no alternative but to unite.
Right.
And they are going to do it because the people on each side of that political divide see a movement to take back the country, not just the two-party system, because Trump has already said that he's going to destroy the Republican Party. Well, he's already done that. And the Sanders people in the streets are saying that if Hillary gets the nomination, there's nothing in the Democratic Party left to save, and it has to be destroyed.
Yeah, and I would add to that that, in fact, Trump didn't destroy the Republican Party. He was maybe an agent of it, but the Republican constituency itself walked away.
They
said, you know what? Buy Ted Cruz, buy Marco Rubio, buy Jeb Bush, buy all the rest of you all. We are now going with that guy who said he's going to give us a job, and we've seen him on TV. He might do it.
That's it. That's it.
That's how much legitimacy they had.
That's right.
That's what that's a measure
of. That's right. And you know, it's just a wonderful time to be alive. People, you know, the Hillary people are fear-mongering.
Yep.
And even in the left, you have to be afraid of those people on the Trump side. And, I tried to talk about this with a lot of people back here in Philly and in the movement. And I said, you know, I was there. I didn't feel like I was in a Ku Klux Klan rally or a Nazi party meeting.
The Klan very rarely buys you a couple of beers.
Right. Or dances with you to some songs of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah.
You know, I have felt at times more racism, perhaps unconscious, in progressive circles than I felt out there.
I didn't feel it there.
There was a welcoming attitude.
I didn't feel hate there. I didn't feel anger there. The only anger I saw was when they brought up the issue of, you know, certain things that have been restraining, you know, that basically blocking these people from actualizing their needs.
Right.
When they talked about Ted Cruz, you could see them get angry. And it wasn't like, foaming at the mouth. It's just like, he's done.
Yeah.
He's over. Yeah. He showed what he is, and now we know what he is. That's that. Next. Mm-hmm. And what they're looking for, though, is something affirmative. They want to open the factories up in Cleveland. They want to put the people back to work.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do things that are going to encourage development and encourage growth. And we're not talking about the Republican talking points of let's cut taxes and give subsidies and all that. They want a program of development that's going to put their communities back to work. Mm-hmm. And they want to have hands-on with it as it goes forward.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we hear from the people that are behind Bernie Sanders.
That's right. That's right. There's no... And you know, when Ted Cruz gave his... speech, I was going to say fateful speech, the speech that literally ends his political career.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, self-eulogy or obituary,
right.
Which was a beautiful thing and a poetic thing to see, poetic justice.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Because don't forget, he was the Tea Party candidate.
That's right.
He was the Party candidate.
Right. All the things he accuses Trump of, he traded in his entire career.
That's
right. Short though it ended up being.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful thing.
That's right.
But you know, after the speech, and as his wife was leaving under armed guard the convention floor, they were shouting at her, Goldman Sachs,
that's right.
Goldman Sachs.
Right.
I mean, now, what does that tell you? And what do we have to learn from that?
Well, we've heard that here, too.
Absolutely. You see my point?
Yeah,
and who is... I mean, if Ted Cruz's wife is Goldman Sachs, then Hillary is Goldman Sachs on steroids.
That's right. That's right.
With speeches, the transcripts of which she refuses to make public.
Right. That's right. Yeah, so... Now, looking at things going forward, I guess coming out of here, we're going to see how it gets portrayed. But it's clear that this party is divided, and I would say fractured is a more accurate term, and maybe even that there's been an amputation or there's one in process.
Mm-hmm.
With that condition, and with what we saw as a unified campaign, I don't know if you call it a Republican Party or whatever, but a unified Trump campaign movement with. You know, the appendages of the Republican Party in place to use because they're under his control, in essence. You have looming this economic collapse again, which may happen before November. Certainly, it's going to be the looming aspect of it is going to be more pronounced as the job numbers keep coming in the way they are, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you see as being a strategy that Clinton's going to play? She's going to be playing catch-up, I think, by the end of this week. I mean, we'll see, but how does she do that?
Well, the question is, will Clinton be allowed to speak on Thursday?
It's a question now, isn't it?
You know? And if she leaves here without being allowed to speak, now, so then she is humiliated.
Right.
And so she leaves Philadelphia with her tail between her legs, with 70% almost of the American electorate saying they don't trust her.
Yeah, right. That's important.
This is very important. The next question becomes, can she be the candidate? Will she be forced to drop out and pass the baton to Tim Kaine and Elizabeth Warren?
Right.
I mean, we're looking at a situation of system breakdown. And in the face of a rising people and working class opposition. And this is what Antonio Gramsci referred to, and I like to always use this concept, a new historic bloc. He was even more specific. A counter-hegemonic historic block. We could be even more specific as relates to our situation. An anti-Wall Street, anti-elite, historic block organically emerging from the working people.
Do you think we've, I don't want to use the word evolved, perhaps devolved, to a point where the, you know, the classes that Marx described, you know, are no longer fairly described with those terms. Certainly you could say that about the working class, because you were talking proletariat at the time. That was, you know, the industrial proletariat, and, you know, there's almost no industrial base in the United States, and there's a whole lot of proletariat. You know, the bourgeoisie, who were really just the owners of, I would just say the owners, period, not of, the means of production, but of everything, of everything else but the people. So given maybe the different nature of the two classes, although the intensified sameness of the relationship that Marx described, do they behave differently, you know, in the process of evolution, you know, the kind that Marx described?
Well, you know, and that's the big question. What does class and what does class conflict look like in the 21st century and in late capitalism or financialized capitalism, globalized capitalism, and especially in the nation which constitutes a military and economic empire which is trying to dominate the world? You know, I think we have to look at different phenomenologies. That doesn't mean the rejection of Marx, but it means that Marx's basic insight and analysis have to be expanded. Du Bois talks about what I would call a tripartite situation, where the question of the two distinct elements of the working class, the black and white, you know, he talks about the white poor,
right,
as a metaphor for the white working class itself, and the black worker. You know, these two dynamics, whether they come together in a single class or alliance against the financial ruling class. The task of the left is not to spout slogans about the working class, but to understand both its objective unity and the subjective and historically constituted segmentation of it based upon race. Now, once we talk about race, I think what we have to understand is that race is the problem. It is not the solution. The color line is the problem, as Du Bois said. It is not the solution. The solution is in overcoming the barriers of the color line within the masses in order to move in a united way against the enemy of all classes in the society.
So clearly, the way towards that, towards removing that barrier, is not to incite it, you know, the way Trump has done, for example.
Absolutely.
But also, the way towards that is not to disqualify a broad sector of the white poor, white working class as being inherently racist just by saying they're inherently racist.
That's right. Well, that's a way of guaranteeing that you don't have to do anything. If you're white and all you say is all those white people are racist and they're on the verge of becoming fascist, well, then that takes any responsibility off of your shoulders and makes you comfortable in saying, well, I'm an ally of black people. You know, well, in fact, I don't think black people need allies. Black people need organic forces that are connected to the working class.
Right. I mean, you know, not for nothing, where did Malcolm tell white people to go work?
In their communities.
And what was he talking about? He wasn't talking about, you know, go sell coupons to the next black dinner somewhere or whatever in the white community.
No. Or to label them.
Yeah.
Especially at a time when they are suffering and there's immiseration and they are looking for a way out of this crisis.
That's right.
And to label them, you know, ipso facto racist and fascist is, frankly, not Marxism. It is a crime against the very vision that Marx put forward in the 19th century.
Yeah, because the thing that occurs to me is this. As they say, you see how, basically, how stupid these mm-hmm. people are, how evil they are, mm-hmm. how racist they are. They're so easily misled by this guy, Trump. Mm-hmm. The first question that occurs to me is, exactly what the hell have you offered them as an alternative?
That's right. It's outrageous. And now we see something emerging that is so new, that is, in fact, so appropriate to this historic moment. And if you are not able to become a part of it and to celebrate it and try to give it direction, Trump is not the answer. Sanders is not the answer.
That's right.
The people are the answer.
That's right.
And leadership, whether it comes from the established left, most of which I consider to be infantile and dogmatic,
or compromised,
or whether it comes from the people who are in struggle. I think it's going to come maybe from both sides. I think there are elements among the younger left who will grow up in this movement, will come to understand what is happening. But nonetheless, I think we are on the cusp of a great moment in history, whether it's the beginning of the end, as Du Bois called it, the dusk of dawn, or not, it's hard to say. But it is the beginning of something, and hopefully it will be the beginning of the end.
So, just to wrap it up, you went to a few of the events that took place here in Philly, because there are all these satellite events that are taking place that help people understand who's on what side.
Mm-hmm.
The people that are in the streets marching against Hillary Clinton are organizing other events. Describe some of those events, if you will.
Well, you know, there are hundreds of events going on. And you know, no one really knows how many of them there are or where they're all at. I was at an event for political prisoners on Sunday, and then I was at another event where the socialist city councilwoman from Seattle, Kashama Sawat, spoke along with others. Yesterday, I was at the Great March of Thousands, where we marched on the convention and literally shamed the Hillary delegates. I was at another event, a rally, seemed like 1,000 people for Jill Scott. Jill Stein, where Cornel West and Chris Hedges and others spoke. Tonight I'm going to be at an event, in fact I'm speaking at an event of the Socialist Convergence on the question of racism and the struggle. And it's just so many things going on. There's a march today, two marches at least today. One coming from the black community, or at least originating in the black community, and another originating in Center City, and they're supposed to come together and they're marching on the DNC. You know, today is going to be a great demonstration when there's the roll call of delegates.
That's right.
And that will be a moment of protest.
That's right. That's right. That was one of the things I noticed last night, that when Sanders was making his almost concession speech last night, or his mm-hmm. attempted a concession speech, one of the first things he said was that I'm looking forward to having a full roll call vote on the delegates, where all 1,800 and whatever of my delegates will be heard. And you saw the mood of those folks. They're going to be heard. They're not just going to say aye or
that's
whatever.
That's right. Because, see, the mood of the delegates is not the same as Bernie Sanders' mood.
That's right.
Bernie Sanders is not conceding. He is surrendering.
That's right.
His people could more go along with a concession, but a surrender, they're not going to accept.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
All right, Tony, thank you very much, man.
Thank you, Don. Always a pleasure.
We'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay.
Today's editorial commentary comes from Glenn Ford of BlackAgendaReport.com.
Hillary Clinton and her huckster husband, Slick Willie, seem to specialize in bringing harm to black people. The public record, stretching back many decades, proves they are Class A racists who've destroyed countless black lives in the service of corporate interests and their own private greed. The Clintons' crimes against the people of Haiti are but one chapter in the blood-soaked saga of the most vile American couple ever to stride the global stage. The U.S. State Department, still emitting the stink of Hillary Clinton's stewardship in Barack Obama's first term, last week announced it would withdraw financial support for new presidential elections planned for Haiti in October. That's just fine with most Haitians, who know that when the U.S. finances Haitian elections, it gets what it pays for. A government of gangsters in service to multinational corporations and a local elite that fears and despises the poor majority. A broad consensus of Haiti's political spectrum agreed to restart the election process from scratch and to discard the results of last year's rigged elections that would have kept the political faction headed by former President Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly in power. Martelly, a profane nightclub singer and close associate of terrorists and drug lords, became president in 2011 through a rigged election engineered by U.S. Secretary of State Clinton. Martelly spent much of his term ruling by decree, ruthlessly suppressing the parties of Haiti's poor majority, allowing gold mining companies and other foreign extraction industries to illegally take over vast stretches of countryside, and seizing coastal properties and islands for the benefit of multinational tourism corporations. American companies and NGOs got the lion's share of the billions raised to rebuild the country after the devastating earthquake of 2010, with Martelly's gangster class skimming off the crumbs. The Clintons' goal was to transform Haiti into the sweatshop of the Caribbean by keeping Haitian labor dirt cheap at places like the Clinton Foundation's Caracol Industrial Park. Bill Clinton preached that Haiti's poverty provided it with a competitive advantage, so the Clintons tried their best to keep Haiti as poor as possible. Hillary Clinton bullied Haiti and rigged its elections through the State Department, and former President Bill Clinton lorded it over the country as special United Nations envoy, while the Clinton Foundation spent $36 million doing who knows what, and the Clinton Global Initiative managed as much as $500 million in aid money designated for Haiti. Meanwhile, 7,000 Haitians died from a cholera epidemic brought into the country by a UN occupation force that reduced Haiti to an international protectorate. Protected, that is, from the democratic aspirations of the Haitian people themselves. As Martelly's term drew to a close last year, his government stole two more elections with the approval of the United States, which paid for the crime and told Haiti to accept the outcome. But the Haitians said, keep your money, and are going ahead with new elections in October. This should mark an end to the infinitely corrupt Clinton era in Haiti, except that the Clintons will likely be on their way back to the White House in November, positioning them to pollute the whole planet with their noxious, lethal sleaze and criminality. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar, reporting from Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. Thanks for listening.